I'd like to read an extract from the book The Age of Consent, Manifesto for a New World Order by George Monbiot. George Monbiot is from somewhere in England. He's a columnist for the Guardian newspaper and author of a few books. He's held visiting professorships and fellowships at the universities of Oxford, Bristol, Keele and East London, in subjects ranging from philosophy to environmental science. In 1995, Nelson Mandela presented him with a United Nations Global 500 Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement. In his book he talks about the idea of anarchism. At first sight, anarchism appears more compatible with the ideals of a global justice movement. It is a political idea I find most attractive, and to which, almost instinctively, however much I have now come to reject it intellectually, I keep returning. For the first few years in which I had a system of political beliefs, I considered myself an anarchist. Anarchism's purpose, of course, is to reclaim human freedom from the oppressive power of distant authority. Every atrocity committed by the state is a standing advertisement for self-government. Over the past 100 years, as everyone knows, states have been responsible for the deaths of tens of millions of combatants and civilians in wars, concocted principally for the purpose of expanding the wealth and power of the dominant elite. They have sought to destroy entire ethnic or religious groups, Jews, Roma, Tartars, Kurds, Tutsis, Bosnian Muslims, East Timorese, Maya, Mapuches and many more. They have even engineered famines, destroyed ecosystems, killed political opponents and curtailed the most basic human freedoms. Those who have succeeded in capturing the wealth and power of the state have enriched themselves enormously at public expense. Both King Leopold of Belgium and his indigenous successor, Mobutu Sese Seko, used the Congo as his personal treasury, effectively enslaving an entire nation for the purpose of filling his own pockets. The men and women who have governed all the recent superpowers, Britain, the USSR and the United States, have sought to enhance their power and secure domestic support without redistributing wealth, by seizing control of other nations and looting their economies. When anarchists assert that the state is a mechanism for violently depriving humankind of its freedom, we are forced to agree that it has repeatedly been used for this purpose. Anarchism, as a result, presents the most consistent, and within a global justice movement, the most popular challenge to the world order. This manifesto invokes, in which governance plays a major role. But the history of the past century, or even for that matter the past decade, is hardly an advertisement for statelessness either. When the government of Sierra Leone lost control of its territory, the lives of its people were ripped apart by men who are commonly described as rebels. But who possessed no policy or purpose other than to loot people's homes and monopolize the diamond trade. They evolved the elegant habit of hacking off the hands of the civilians they visited, not because this advanced any political or economic program, but simply because no one was preventing them from doing so. Only when foreign states reasserted governance in Sierra Leone were the bandits defeated and relieved of their weapons. When the state effectively collapsed in the former Soviet Union, losing its capacity to regulate and tax its citizens, the power vacuum was filled immediately, not by autonomous collectives of happy householders, but by the mafia, which carved its empires out of other people's lives. The assets of the former state were seized not by the mass of its citizens, but by a few dozen kleptocrats. Anyone who sought to resist them was shot. For most of the past decade, the Eastern Congo has been effectively stateless, and the people who in earlier eras endured the depredations of King Leopold and President Mobutu have been repeatedly attacked by six marauding armies and scores of unaffiliated militias squabbling over their resources. 2 million people have died as a result of this civil war. Anarchists would be quick to insist both that there is a difference between the stateless chaos of places like the Eastern Congo and true anarchism, in which freely associating communities can seek mutual advantage through cooperation, and that many of the recent atrocities in stateless places were caused either by the collapse of the state or by the aggression of neighbouring states. We will turn to the first point in a moment, but it should surely be obvious that the second argument causes more problems for the anarchist position than it solves. Unless anarchism suddenly and simultaneously swept away all the world's states and then, by equally mysterious means, prevented new states from emerging, it is hard to see how the people of anarchist communities could survive when thrust into conflict or competition with a neighbouring state, which, by definition, would possess the wherewithal to raise an army. It is just as difficult to see how they could defend themselves from the robber barons arising within their own territories, who would perceive this collapse not as an opportunity to embrace their fellow humans in the spirit of love and reconciliation, but as an opportunity to embrace their undefended resources. It is impossible to read any history, ancient or modern, without acquiring the unhappy intelligence that, Homo sapiens is a species with an extraordinary capacity for violence and destruction, and that this capacity has been exercised in most epochs in all regions of the world. Those who wish to exert power over other people or to seize their resources appear to use violence as either a first or a last resource. Unless this tendency is checked by some other force, principally the fear of punishment by people with greater means of violence at their disposal. Any political system which seeks to enhance human welfare must provide the means of containing and preventing the aggression with which some people would greet others. The state claims to do so by asserting a monopoly of violence, by attesting that only the servants of the state are permitted to use violence against other people, and then only according to the rules the state lays down. It pretends to offer protection to its citizens, both from external aggression and from people with violent tendencies within its own borders. In theory, a democratic state is prevented by accountability to its people from the arbitrary use of that violent power against its own citizens. The notional safeguards against its own use of violence towards the people of other nations are less clear-cut. Indeed, this is among the global democratic deficits which this manifesto seeks to address. In mature democracies, arbitrary violence by the state against its own people is fairly limited. The police sometimes beat up protesters and members of ethnic minorities and extort confessions from suspects by violent means, while the security service occasionally assassinate troublesome citizens. The anarchist would argue with justice that the relatively low frequency and low intensity of state violence in democratic nations reflects the fact that most citizens most of the time obey the state, whether they agree with its prescriptions or not. If people were more inclined to behave as they wished, in other words, if they were more free, they would be subject to a corresponding increase in state violence. Nor will democratic states always succeed in protecting their own people from the violence of others. There is no shortage of recent examples of popular governments being deposed by external aggression. There are also plenty of instances of state authorities turning a blind eye while a faction with which they sympathise assaults a faction towards which they are antagonistic. Recent attacks on Muslims in India have been passively witnessed and occasionally abetted by police and soldiers. In Britain, as I know to my cost, the police have often refused to intervene when protesters are beaten up by private security guards. But this system, with the significant caveat that it does not as yet prevent the state from attacking the people of other nations, does at least function in theory. It could be argued that both the state's own arbitrary violence and its toleration of the violence of certain favoured citizens are the results of the failure of its people to hold the authorities sufficiently to account. It is possible to see how, in a mature democratic state, effective campaigning by the victims of violence or their supporters could be turned into such a public embarrassment and electoral liability that the government is forced to desist. Indeed, on many occasions precisely this has happened. There can, or so we should be inclined to hope, never be another Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland.
The short chapter.
Peacock. Or another sinking of a rainbow warrior by the French security services. Such a strange as democratic states display arises only from fear of losing public support and therefore losing power. No state but the dominant superpower can guarantee to defend its citizens from external aggression, but the state does appear to be rather more capable of doing so. When it is responsive to the will of its people than unaffiliated autonomous communities. Indeed, one of the reasons why both the Roman Empire and 2,000 years later the British Empire expanded so swiftly is that many of the tribes they attacked were either aggregated only loosely into states or were not aggregated at all. Had there been no state of Nicaragua, the proxy warriors financed by the US could have overrun that region immediately, seizing the land and its resources from its people. The Sandinista government was far weaker than the United States, but through ingenious organization it succeeded in resisting the greater power for several years, during which it mustered the support both of other nations and of many people within the US. The eventual settlement was almost certainly less oppressive than it would have been had the proxy warriors not encountered a regular army and a resistance and public relations coordinated by the state. It is not clear, by contrast, that anarchism works even in theory. The problem with the model is that, for the reasons outlined above, it has either to be applied universally or applied only in those regions which are so poor in resources that no one else would want to live there. In other words, if states continue to exist, they will seize from relatively defenseless peoples the assets which would be their own, be to their advantage. Anarchist communities which possess valuable resources can sometimes survive for short periods in accessible places, are for longer periods in remote and impassable regions. Their establishment has often been associated with emancipation and within the community redistribution. But these communities are always likely to be vulnerable to attack by these federations of people, which we call states, big enough to command armies and rich enough to deploy advanced military technology. But let us suppose, as many anarchists do, that this system can somehow displace all states simultaneously worldwide. What we then discover is that this very universalism destroys the freedoms the anarchists wish to defend. Anarchists, like most people who support particular political systems, see those systems as responding to people rather like themselves. Most anarchists associate with oppressed communities and envisage anarchism as the means by which the oppressed can free themselves from persecution. But if everyone is to be free from the coercive power of the state, then this must apply to the oppressors as well as the oppressed. The richest and most powerful communities on earth, be they geographical communities or communities of interest, will be as unrestrained by external forces as the poorest and weakest. This is why, though both sides would furiously deny it, the outcome of both market fundamentalism and anarchism, if applied universally, is identical. The anarchists associate with the oppressed, the market fundamentalists with the oppressors. But by eliminating the state, as some, but by no means all the market fundamentalists wish to do, both simply remove such restraints as prevent the strong from crushing the weak. This, of course, is the point of market fundamentalism, but is also the inevitable result of anarchism. If you have difficulty envisaging this, simply picture an autonomous community of impoverished black people living next to an autonomous community of well-armed white races. For the majority of humankind to be free, we must restrain the freedom of those who would oppress us. So the anarchists would have us make another extraordinary leap of faith. Having caused the state magically to evaporate everywhere, they also insist, without providing a convincing explanation of how this might happen in the absence of the state, that we can eliminate those disparities of wealth and power between communities which would permit one group of people to oppress another. But even that would prove inadequate. Even if every community had equal access to resources, there is nothing in the anarchist system to prevent one group from seeking to acquire more resources by invading another. Indeed, precisely this happens almost continuously. Among the nomadic tribes of the part of Africa where the borders of Sudan, Ethiopia, Uganda and Kenya meet, there are classic anarchist communities with centuries of organisational experience and far more sophisticated means of managing their resources and resolving disputes than the intentional communes of the West. They are forced into cooperation with the tribe by the erratic ecology of the lands they inhabit and their consequent inability to sustain the accumulation of wealth. They have been, by and large, abandoned by central government. Their loyalty to other members of the tribe is unimpeachable. Whenever the livestock belonging to another tribe come within range and are insufficiently defended, those men with sufficient arms will attempt to steal them. These forays, especially since the arrival of modern weapons, can be exceedingly bloody. When I was working with the Turkana of northwestern Kenya, my visit to a cattle camp was delayed by illness. By the time I arrived, all that remained of its people were their skulls and the remain of their clothes, scattered across the savannah after their bodies had been eaten by hyenas. Warriors from another tribe had arrived in the night, surrounded the camp and inoculated it with bullets. 96 of its 98 people were killed. The anarchists may respond that the brotherhood of man has, in this case, been corrupted by modern weaponry. There is no question that automatic weapons have accelerated conflict, but long before they first experienced the electrifying sensation of holding the stock of a gun, the people of these anarchist communities murdered their enemies when they perceived that they were favoured by the balance of power. Indeed, another anarchist tribe, the Massey, armed only with spears and knives, seized almost all the grazing lands of what is now central and southern Kenya and northern Tanzania, within a century of emerging from the regions and Turkana, and from the region the Turkana now inhabit. So the anarchists, as well as disposing of states, greed, wealth and power, would also need to disinvent all weapons which could be used to harm another person. Not just bombs and automatic rifles, but also, as the massacres in Rwanda show, any bit of metal, stone or wood which can be sharpened on one side or knocked into a point. Theirs may be the perfect political system for another planet, inhabited by life forms whose responses to scarcity and competition are the very opposite of ours. Regrettably, it is not a system destined to enhance the lives of those who live here.